Welcome to We Are Libertarians, a weekly podcast about current events and philosophy from a young libertarian's point of view. I'm Chris Galt with your hosts Chris Spangle and Creighton Harrington.
Hello.
Hey, guys.
Hello.
So, besides Game of Thrones episode 2 this week and the Old Republic 1.2 patch that launched today, there was also some exciting election news.
I'm surrounded by so many nerds right now.
The Old Republic what?
Star Wars The Old Republic, an MMO.
Oh, wow.
Come on, guys.
I am a Star Wars nerd, but I mean, you're celebrating the patch.
That's
a little hardcore.
It's the largest free patch in MMO history.
So what does that mean? Like, you put on in your jacket?
Anyway, there was some exciting election.
He's got his Star Wars badge.
There was some you guys.
It's like a star. You got your little transponder.
All right. So there was some also exciting election news that I think we should talk about.
So this is how liberty dies. Thunderous applause.
Okay. All right.
Rick Santorum dropped out or suspended his campaign this week. My question I pose to you guys, how does Santorum's campaign suspension affect the presidential race? And does this make Mitt Romney the eventual nominee?
Well, it makes it less likely that he'll be president, which is pretty cool.
Yeah, we dodged a bullet there.
I'd say, just based upon what I was watching last night, looking into it, the only thing I'm really worried about is the delegate apportionment that he had accrued. From what I understand, the bound delegates, the states where the state rules, I think Louisiana is one of those, where the delegates are apportioned based upon the percentage that you got in the straw poll. And Louisiana is an example. Mitt Romney got half, essentially, and Santorum got half of their delegates. Ron Paul or Newt Gingrich didn't get any because they didn't make a 25% margin. But those delegates in states like that are bound to vote for Santorum even though he's not running at the convention. So they have to vote on the first round. If the convention goes brokered, then they can vote for whoever they want.
Well, do you know if there's a difference between suspending your campaign and ending it?
From what I understand, his campaign is pretty much absolutely over. The only reason he's suspending it is because there's a bunch of tax and loopholes and formalities and red tape he has to go through before it's officially canceled.
It's a way to essentially just sort of suspend the campaign. You can continue to pay some staff to kind of wind everything down. But it's pretty much over. I mean, he wouldn't have any shot at going to a brokered convention and winning.
But the unbound delegates are still unbound. And the good thing about those is, for the most part, though, I mean, even the ones that are bound, I mean, it's important for people like Ron Paul to get those delegates anyway, to get his people into those positions, because if the convention goes brokered, then they can vote for Ron Paul. The unbound is always fun, though. Those ones are still unbound, and they're still in the process of being selected on various states. I understand that in Clark, no, it was Missouri, I think, one of the really, really controversial ones where a guy got arrested because the county GOP broke a bunch of state election laws and didn't follow Robert's rules when they were electing all the delegates and stuff, and they shut down the convention for that county. And essentially because Ron Paul's people had taken it over, and if they had followed rules, then it would have been like every single delegate would have been a Ron Paul guy. Well, I guess they rescheduled that and did it, and Ron Paul took over, and all of his delegates got it.
Did you guys see? I actually posted it on my Facebook, and I'll post it to the We Are Libertarians Facebook at wearelibertarians.com. That's a link to it. Did you see the slating piece? It was in somewhere in the Southwest. I think it was Arizona or New Mexico, where it was the official Republican Party slating piece for the county, and it showed the candidates that they preferred, and then it said at the top, and the person who got the slating piece highlighted it, it said, vote for absolutely no Ron Paul delegates. Like, do not vote for these people at all. So that was the official party line in this county in the Southeast. Do not vote for Ron Paul delegates whatsoever.
Yeah, and I feel like that's pretty much been, you know, assumed in a lot of these county GOP.
We've seen it across,
the state. There's been police have been called to a bunch of them, and because the Ron Paul people essentially know what's going on as far as how the laws work, better than any of the other candidates, grassroots people. The only ones that are the other candidates that get it are, you know, kind of like the higher ups. They're the state leaders and all that stuff. They already, you know, they're bought and paid for already.
Right.
Ron Paul's people are coming in and they know it. Each individual one of them knows how it works. And they're, you know, calling BS and shenanigans every time something goes wrong. And they're essentially getting their way. I mean, it hasn't been 100% success, but from what I understand, from what I've been reading, a majority of the times there have been contested, you know, delegate apportionments and getting Ron Paul people as delegates, they have been pretty successful from what I understand. All of the fraud and stuff has been like just the straw polls, which don't really mean anything,
mm-hmm.
Like Nevada and all that kind of stuff. That's kind of been where, oh, there could be fraud, there could not be. It's a gray area. But as far as the actual delegate apportionment that is really not complete yet, I understand that Ron Paul's people are doing fairly well at getting into those positions. And that's probably why he isn't stopping. I mean, I would say that he's saying that he's got a movement going and all this and he wants to educate and do his stuff. And I believe that's true to an extent. But I feel like if he wasn't doing good as far as his strategy, which has always been delegate from the beginning, I feel like he would have dropped out and done something else to get more media attention or something. I don't know. Just I feel like the fact that he's still in, I think he's still doing fairly well.
Yeah, part of the reason is that most people don't ever read their own party's bylaws, and they don't read their own rules. They don't read the standing rules. They just sort of go in, they vote how they've always kind of voted. And what the Ron Paul delegates and the Ron Paul people at the local level have done a great job of doing is studying the party rules, studying the bylaws, studying election code, and knowing the rules inside and out, and knowing Robert's rules. And that has given them an advantage. So when they try to contest something and then the party officials, the party establishment goes and looks it up, then they go, oh, crap, these people are right. You know, because it's just sort of not really followed. Most people don't read their bylaws because bylaws are only really used in an organization when there's problems, you know. And so that's a great lesson for our generation of politically active people is know your organization's bylaws, know the rules, and follow them.
And what I think is a little ironic is, and I have absolutely no evidence to back this up, but I have this feeling that this very convoluted delegate apportionment process really was put in place to make it difficult for people like Ron Paul to get elected. I feel like it's so convoluted because they don't want, you know, outsiders, quote, quote.
Do you think? They've spent 180 years writing their own party's rules to keep heretics out.
But it's just so funny because Ron Paul is essentially just, you know, destroying them at their own game.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why, I mean, you're not going to hear a word about, you know, Newt Gingrich or Ron Paul for the rest of this election season in any way other than, oh, they're still in there. Isn't that funny? Ha ha, they're so dumb. But when it really comes down to it, and Chris, Spangle probably will not agree with me on this, I think that if it goes to Tampa and it goes brokered, I think Ron Paul has a substantial chance at actually doing well. And I wouldn't say that it's, you know, he has the highest percentage chance, but I would say he has enough of a chance to raise an eyebrow at. And I think if it goes brokered, we could see a huge upset.
I will let you guys try to convince me, but I'm cynical, and I will tell you that the game... Are you trying to hold my hand? Galt just like touched my hand. Like, what in the world? And so I don't see any chance on the face of the earth that Ron Paul can go to a brokered convention in Tampa and become the nominee.
Well, they thought the same thing about Warren Harding in the 1920s.
Oh, what a...
Well, I mean, facts are facts, and if you look at history, Warren G. Harding
is the model.
He did. And
I will start researching Warren G. Harding right after I play with my patch.
Well, I mean, Harding is a good example, and I'm sure Chris will expand on that. Before I let him do that, though, we also have to understand that there is a very particular important person who used the exact same strategy that Ron Paul's using, and his name is Barack Obama. Barack Obama was not in the lead going into the Democratic National Convention. He was behind Hillary. Everyone thought Hillary was going to win it, but she didn't because Barack Obama was taking up delegates and taking up delegates and delegates and delegates, and he got more delegates there
And then we got into all the superdelegates. But that was in 2007. We're now in 2008. At this point in 2008, it was the two of them neck and neck, and it was a competition. You know, where it even got to Indiana, where Hillary and Barack come to Indiana and start. You know, I saw Barack twice in Indianapolis. I saw Hillary at Ben Davis. And I saw Bill Clinton in Greenfield. I mean, they were stumping all across the state of Indiana, and it was one versus the other. What we have now is the media is not creating that environment. What we have now is Mitt Romney versus Barack Obama. That's already the theme.
But
you know,
I don't think...
the point that the Daily Show is showing Newt Gingrich headquarters in the 1993 Ford Explorer.
Well,
you know,
I mean, I'm not saying that it's an exact replica of that. What I am pointing out is that. The fundamental thing that is the same is the battle over delegates. The media may not do whatever they want to do.
But Ron Paul is fourth in delegates.
He is fourth in delegates. He is fourth in pledge. But that's the whole his strategy. That's the whole thing. From the very beginning, his idea was to get people that support Ron Paul, get them to these county conventions, and even if they have to vote for Santorum, make it be their people. Because they're only pledged for one round. After that, they're whoever they want to vote for. And you can't buy off a Ron Paul delegate. You can buy off a Mitt Romney guy. You can convince a Santorum guy. You can convince a Newt Gingrich guy that their guy sucks. But you're not going to convince a Ron Paul guy. They might as well be bound to Ron Paul, even if on paper they're not. That's the point. That is the point that's going to make the difference.
But,
and the media is going to sell it as fourth.
But when you add up the amount of Mitt, Newt, Herman Cain, you remember that guy? I saw a picture of Herman Cain the other day, and I was like, oh, I remember him. You add up all these people, and it is Ron Paul versus all of these other candidates' delegates. And a Rick Santorum delegate is going to choose Mitt Romney or Newt Gingrich over Ron Paul every time because they view him as a heretic.
I would say
he's not a social conservative because he's anti-war.
Oh, I think he's very socially conservative. And I think a lot of evangelicals can respect Ron Paul.
But Ron Paul they want someone who will go out and like Mike Pence, like Rick Santorum, legislate their morality. And Ron Paul will not do that. And they will not vote for somebody who will not legislate the way that they want them to legislate.
No, and I agree that a lot of Rick Santorum people are not going to be able to turn into Ron Paul people. But I will say there's a significant portion of basically hardcore evangelical Republicans that like Ron Paul because
sure.
He's so Baptist. And I think you can get those guys. But the point I'm trying
to make... He's a very honorable man. I'm not saying that he's not a conservative. I'm saying that those people don't view him. The anti-war issue and the civil liberties issue... is enough to social conservatism aside, you know, when you get to the second ballot and you've got a choice between Ron Paul and Mitt Romney, the majority of that body of the Republican Party is going to choose Mitt Romney over Ron Paul.
I don't agree with it, but that's exactly what they're going to do. Only if those candidates got their delegates to go to the convention. Ron Paul is taking over the amount of delegates he's getting to go to Tampa in the first place.
But how many realistically?
I don't know the exact numbers. I'm fairly certain that as far as – and it's like an under-the-radar thing, but I'm fairly certain that as far as people getting delegates, Ron Paul is doing extremely – they even had a Freudian slip on Morning Joe. They're talking about if the convention went brokered, who's going to have the most delegates, blah, 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 blah. And one of the guys goes, well, right now it's Ron Paul.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, so they know what's up. The media is not going to present it, but they know what's going on.
Well, let's shift from MSNBC to the Warren G. Harding report and fill us in on what happened in the 1920 convention.
Do either of you guys know how the Republican convention works, the national convention works?
Nah.
When it comes to nominating the president?
No. The last brokered convention really was Reagan and Ford in 76, and none of us were alive then. So.
Well, from what I understand, you go there with your delegates. Whoever has 1,144 this year gets it. If no one gets it, then there's a second round of voting, and then there's no rules as to who they can vote for as long as it's a declared candidate.
Right. So round one, only pledged delegates can vote.
And now with Rick Santorum out of the race... Is it possible for Mitt Romney to go to places like Indiana and all these various places and get that number of delegates with the amount of primaries that are left?
Possibly. I don't know. I haven't done the math.
Okay.
But as far as like Santorum's pledged delegates still have to vote for Santorum, even though he's out.
Mm-hmm.
Herman Cain's, any of them that came out of New Hampshire with what's-his-face, I don't remember his name.
Oh, Huntsman.
Huntsman.
Yeah.
Any of those, they still have to vote for them. So the Mitt Romney can't get those. And a lot of states, like Newt Gingrich, got a lot of pledged delegates. A lot of the states he won were apportioned for.
They can
pledged.
if the candidate releases them. I think.
I don't think so. I think by law they have to vote for that person.
I don't think the candidate
can give it up at all.
I think they can release them. They can because I've heard that done in the past. I think Hillary did that. She verbally released all of her delegates to go vote for Barack Obama at the convention. Neither of us know the answer for sure, so if you know, please let us know. So, Galt.
Why I brought up Harding, though, was because it's an example of how the convention this year will go. It will happen like this. It might not happen as in Warren Harding or Ron Paul winning, but it will happen as in, like Creighton said, the first ballot, all the pledged delegates have to vote. Romney's going to take a huge start. Leap forward, you know. So in the Warren Harding election in the 20s, Harding went into the convention in, I mean, there were five main candidates that were still in it at the convention. And Harding was in the bottom after the first round. He got 65 votes in round one.
He was a congressman from Ohio, right? Columbus.
Or senator, I think.
Senator
from Ohio.
He was sort of like Ford, where he basically was well respected in the Washington community. You know, even though Harding had a few skeletons in his closet, and if any of you watch Boardwalk Empire, you may know about those skeletons. He was the Bill Clinton of his era. Let's put it that way.
But going into the convention, everyone thought that Leonard Wood was going to become the nominee. And he went in, and like Romney will do at the national convention this year, he went in and he got almost 300 votes on the first round, almost 300 votes in the second round, over 300 votes in the third and fourth round. So he's almost to that 1144. And basically, it shows, I'm looking at this chart, which is, I know... Wikipedia is not the best source for information, but they do lay out things sometimes very well. They chart it out really well here, and it shows that after the seventh round, Harding just all of a sudden starts getting more votes than everyone else. Actually, after the third round, he starts getting over 100 votes, and it's because he brought more people to the convention, and they just don't get to vote until if the ballots just keep going until someone gets the nomination, his people get to vote the later it goes and the later it goes. And that's how it'll work for Ron Paul. If it went after the 10th round, they declared Harding the nominee. So if it went to 10 rounds, there would only be Ron Paul people left voting at the convention, because all those people would be sitting there just waiting for their turn to vote. That's why they went there. They know that going there doesn't mean they get to vote for Ron Paul. They're going there in case it's brokered, and then they get to, because unpledged delegates can vote for whoever they want.
Do you guys know if Goldwater won outright, or did he win in a brokered convention against Rockefeller?
I don't know. I feel like it was probably brokered, though.
I seem to think that it might have been. We'll have to look that up for next week.
Because I think he got a lot of crap from a lot of people for winning,
uh-huh,
because everyone was like, oh, he can't beat Johnson, and he couldn't because... You know, birth of television campaigning. I feel like it was brokered. We should look that up. I feel like that sounds like something that was brokered.
Mm-hmm.
Hey guys, I looked it up real quick, and Goldwater did not win in a brokered convention. He went in not knowing he was going to be the nominee for sure, but he won in the first round. So,
but it was still very bitter.
But with Harding went on to win the popular, or he won the largest landslide popular vote win in history. Over James Cox, the Democrat,
probably at that
from
time.
Ohio as well. So
it was probably up to that point.
What do what?
It was probably up to that point. I don't know.
I'm pretty sure 60% to 34% is the largest victory.
I don't know. I feel like Reagan beating in 84 probably was bigger.
Both pretty close until Barack Obama in 2012.
Yeah.
I mean, there's a real possibility. Do you guys think that it could be that significant if Mitt Romney's the nominee? Do you think it could be a Johnson or Reagan-like landslide in the mid?
No.
You don't think so?
It's not going to be a landslide. It's not going to be a landslide. I mean, Barack Obama's got an uphill battle in front of him, but I think if he goes up against Mitt Romney, Barack Obama's going
to
beat him.
Not even close. He beat Mondale 58-40.
What was 80 against
80
Carter?
80 was 50, even worse. Hang on. 50-41.
What was Johnson in?
He won more states than Harding did, but Harding won the popular vote enormously.
What was Johnson versus Goldwater in 64?
64 was 61-38. That was pretty close.
61-38. So who had the all-time record? Was it
Warren Harding?
Warren Harding. Okay, all right. Sorry, I wasn't paying attention. I was off somewhere else.
Warren Harding. 60-34 or something like
wow.
that. Yeah.
And didn't he have the
teapot dome? Yeah.
Yeah, thank you.
Well, I bet the Republicans were pretty happy they picked him.
Yeah. Here's a guy with a love child hanging out in Atlantic City.
Harding was not a great president as far as his right. morality, but he did a good job during the recession of 1920 because he didn't do anything.
Yeah, but he also had one of the most corrupt administrations of all time.
But didn't he cut the taxes on the higher?
I'm pretty sure he cut taxes.
I'm pretty
sure he cut taxes, but what happened
taxes.
Was he was still trying to deal with the Teapot Dome scandal. So he really was he couldn't really get anything through. And he even had a speech where he said we need to let this alone, blah, 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 blah.
Right.
And the Federal Reserve, they were still in the gold standard, so the Fed was kind of stuck and they couldn't do as much. Plus, they were brand new, really, and they didn't know what they could do. Keynes hadn't written his general theory yet, so that whole crap wasn't... So they didn't do anything, really.
Tom Woods had a great video on that depression. We'll have to find that and post that.
The 1920 recession was much stronger than the 1929 recession, which is the Great Depression, in its initial downturn. The 1920 downturn was much more dramatic and prominent than the 1929 downturn. However, Harding didn't do much, if anything at all. The Fed didn't do much. And it recovered by 1921, and then you had the Roaring Twenties. 1929 came along. Hoover decided he was going to, you know, it was a new era, and he was going to, you know, help out the poor and all this kind of stuff, which if you read your textbook and they say Hoover was laissez-faire, it's lying. Hoover was not laissez-faire.
He was the exact opposite of
In
Coolidge
fact,
and Harding.
FDR ran against Hoover, saying Hoover was doing too much. So you can actually look at FDR's campaign speeches and look, and he straight up says that Hoover's been doing too much and spending too much. We got to stop it. And then FDR had the FDR presidency.
And then he gets into office, and he starts to see what Hoover saw,
But anyway, so 1929 comes along, Great Depression happens, and they start doing stuff, and it lasts until the end of World War II. So, I mean, you can't really ask for a better economic experiment in history than these two eras. And it's hilarious that they don't ever talk about that, because the first thing that comes up when you talk about government needing to help the economy is that, well, look at what happens today compared to the Great Depression. The Great Depression, blah, 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 we'd have starving people and they'd all be dying. And, you know, you talk about 1920 recessions, they're like, there wasn't a 1920. We skipped over 1920. It went 1919 to 1921. There was no 1920.
Right. That entire decade was totally erased until Hoover got into office.
Yeah. So it'll be an interesting convention this year.
But,
or not.
But we could.
I guess switching gears.
Yeah. Creighton wrote some articles,
I
think.
We have a...
into the mic, buddy.
We have an upcoming event on campus this week, Monday and Tuesday, Young Americans of Liberty does, called Occupy the Honor Roll. It's a national, event. They're trying to get every chapter to do it. And... we've explained it before, and it's kind of just poking fun at the Occupy movement, and it's about we're going to redistribute the GPAs, and it's going to help everybody, blah, 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 just poke fun at the whole movement. Well, on the Young Americans for Liberty at IUPUI group Facebook page, there was a post by someone who I don't even know who it is, but it was a link to an article about essentially, you know, tired old Occupy Wall Street 99% huzzah stuff. And from the outset, I will admit that there are those within the Occupy Wall Street movement that that agree and understand that the main problem is crony capitalism. It's not capitalism inherently, it's crony capitalism. Business running to government, getting protections from the market, asking for monopoly privileges and all this jazz. That's what tends to cause the mass disparity in wealth. And that's what's unjust.
Right.
But a pretty large portion of Occupy Wall Street does not understand that, or they do not want to understand it, and they are just espousing tired old Marxist social class warfare rhetoric that if you ever read a history book about the 1800s, you hear over and over and over, and it's the same old stuff. And I hope they don't feel like they're doing anything new and becoming some innovators as far as their political ideology, because it's the same crap, it's just under a different title.
Well, but they have iPhones now.
Well, yes. They have iPhones and they have better tents,
and
I guess.
Jobs.
But I posted a rebuttal to...
Why don't you give us a smelly hippie while you're at it, Gold?
Well, I posted a rebuttal to
said
article.
Way to reach out to the opposite side.
Yes, we're all about coalitions here. But I posted a rebuttal article to the Occupy Wall Streeters article, and it can be found on the We Are Libertarians Facebook page or wearelibertarians.com, which links to my blog, which I am trying to build as having many contributors. So if you're interested, then hit me up. But anyway, I mean, I'll just read some excerpts from her article. I won't read the whole thing I wrote just because it's too long. But the very beginning of the article is that there's a picture of a person explaining how they work their butt off to get their education. They don't have a good job. They don't have an iPhone and all this kind of stuff. They're okay with that, and they are not part of the 99%, because it was essentially saying that I don't want free handouts. I worked my butt off, blah, blah, blah. And the girl said, I don't know why this person's saying 99% is some metaphorical, blah, blah. It's an actual statistic based upon the tax brackets. And she links to the tax brackets. And I don't know for anyone who's ever heard this argument before that I'm about to give, but it's pretty powerful, I think, it demolishes their whole, like, worldview, I think. But the top 1% of the Americans pay 33.9% of all income taxes, and this is based from 1990 to 2001, and this is the 2001 numbers. So the top 1% paid 33.9%. So technically, she's correct. 99% of Americans pay more taxes than the top 1%. The bottom 99% pay more. However, if you go to the top 5%, the top 5% of Americans pay 53.3% of all taxes in America, income taxes, meaning 95% of Americans pay less than half of the total amount of taxes paid in America. Top 10% pay 65%. The top 25% pay 83%. And the top 50 pay 96, which is pretty understandable. But the top 5% and even the top 10% is not a very large demographic of, you know, average Joe Americans. So anyway, the point that I'm trying to make is the inclusion of these numbers immediately implies that regardless of whether or not Occupy Wall Street has some ideological battle against wealth disparity or they're just upset at inequality, the use of these tax numbers, I believe, implies a general agreement that a policy of redistribution is the solution to said problem. Take from the top, give it the bottom. Peter Pan or Robin Hood.
Peter Pan.
Peter Pan. Yeah. Take from the children and give back to the older
children. Robin Hood. But anyway.
Snow White.
There's – so and
which
we can continue
you,
forward. She
Gold is so – let me pause you for a second while you collect your thoughts there, Creighton. I want to talk about how annoying Chris Gold is. Because every time Creighton goes off on one of his tangents and tries to educate people, Gold basically sits there and, like, makes faces at me trying to get me to laugh. And then I feel bad. And, like, Creighton is, like, spitting this incredible knowledge. He's brilliant. And then Gold's over here like
– I wasn't making crazy faces. I was just smiling.
But upside-down hand glasses.
Whatever.
But I don't want to get super, super technical with the whole article. You can read it if you want. But the gist of the whole thing is that the 99% are basically the 1% became wealthy on the backs of the 99%, and all this exploitation of labor and the middle class and all this crap. And it's ironic to me because I don't know. It shows a fundamental misunderstanding of what a market is. The rich got rich off the backs of the 99%. I can say that is technically true. But the 99% were even able to get money off the backs of the rich. It's not the market is not a zero-sum game.
It's a mutual agreement. It's two people voluntarily associating with each other, and that's what they don't understand, is that they think that it's somehow slave labor. Well, no. The fact is that I work for an employer, and the employer and I have made an agreement on my salary. They get the benefit of my services, and they pay for those services accordingly.
And
if I don't like the amount that I get paid, I can voluntarily leave.
And the fundamental thing that I don't think a lot of people in general understand is wages are not set arbitrarily by an employer. It's not like you go in with your best bargaining skills and the employer comes in and you guys meet in the middle on some number because of whatever metaphysical value you guys determine is should be. No, your wage is determined by how much consumers value the product of your labor.
If somebody buys an iPhone, for example, they take the labor costs, they take the parts costs, they factor all that in, they find out a price for the product, then they mark up a certain amount of profit. You know, it's actually, I've been watching a lot of Pawn Stars lately on the History Channel. And I see people all the time online talking about what a bunch of thieves those guys are and how they swindle people out of their money. Well, no, people voluntarily bring their goods in. They say, I need this much for this item so I can keep my lights on, because I take the risk. When I buy your item for $1,000, I need to resell it because I need to make a profit to keep the doors open so you have a pawn shop to sell your stuff to. Now, if they mark it up 100%, they buy something for $1,000 and sell it for $2,000. That doesn't make them crooks, because everywhere along the line, someone was voluntarily making a transaction. If you are selling your microphone to the guys at the Pawn Stars, you go in and you want $1,000 for it, and they say, no, this is only worth $250. You can take your microphone and walk right out. They're not taking that microphone from you. You're voluntarily selling it to them. You know, but for some reason, people have this notion that the guys on Pawn Stars are a bunch of thieves because they're trying to make profit. And that's a mentality that I don't understand at all.
And I'd call them hustlers.
And what it is
they're good at it.
In a perfect world, if we reached equilibrium as far as the term an economist would use, there is technically no profit in the sense of, you know, you buy cheap and sell high. There's no profit for understanding consumer values better than somebody else and taking advantage. You know, the profit, you know, just the typical buy something that's everyone thinks is a piece of crap, turns out it's really valuable, and then you make a profit off. That kind of profit disappears in equilibrium. You'd still get an accounting profit, but I don't want to get into economic theory too much. But the thing is it's all determined by consumers inherently. It's determined by producers and consumers, but ultimately – if you want to know who's to blame for your low wage, who's to blame for the fact that you can't get paid this much you think your labor is worth, don't blame your employer. Don't blame the stinginess of your employer on dictating you can't pay this much because I don't want to give you that much money. It's not even directly his fault or indirectly. What it comes down to is consumers. You, I, everyone else who buys anything to consume are tyrannical. They're tyrannically stingy on how much they will pay for something. And if demand keeps a price down, if there's not enough demand, then the value of the labor that produces said product will not have a high demand and your wage will go down. The only reason I say this is because a lot of what is at heart in Occupy Wall Street is this idea that there's a labor theory of value and that the workers are getting exploited because they're not getting paid their fair share, and it's all the big bad fat cat capitalist fault, and it's all about the system, and we need to steal money from the top to give to the bottom because the laborers are getting exploited. And it's a tired old argument that has been demolished
part of it isn't wrong. If there's a book by David K. Johnston. He was the tax writer for the New York Times, and he wrote a book called Free Lunch, and he also wrote another book, I can't remember it, but I think it's in Free Lunch, where he talks about the average cost of goods and the average salary. For example, my dad graduated high school, I think, in 1976, and the average wage in 1976 was $33,000. And a house cost $60,000. A car cost $5,000. You could get a hamburger at McDonald's for a dollar or whatever. You know, fast forward to when I graduated high school in 2002. Shut up. When I in 2002, the average salary had dropped to $29,000, and the cost of a house was $160,000, and the cost of that car, that same car, was $25,000. So you do have inflation there. The inflation takes place all of the time. And you have those wages decreasing. We're the first generation of people who will do less. We will be less wealthy than our parents, than the previous generation. And part of the reason is as we've moved towards a global market and there's cheaper labor in places like India and China, and we have to compete. And you're right. We are consumers, so we want cheaper goods. You have several places that you can take capital from to make sure that your products are low. All right. Capital gains, for instance, when you have higher capital gains taxes on business taxes, for instance, to pay those taxes, you can do three things. You can raise the price of your goods, which means you would price yourself out of competition if you're selling a product. So that's not an option. You can't price your goods so high that you aren't competitive. The second is you can take less money, or you can give less money to your investors, which isn't a good idea because then less people invest in your company, so less shares are bought and you have less capital to work with. So the last place you can take money from to sort of subsidize your products to make sure that price is low is the labor market. So because of the global forces, labor has moved down. And, you know, there's – what is it? If you build an iPhone in America, it'd be like $5,000 or something crazy like that. I forget where I heard it. It was like some outrageous number.
They were just made of crap.
Andrew, you know, Android people are the Apple people of the 90s. They're so annoying. Anyways.
And you guys are still dumb.
I'm not the one but my point is that those wages are – they have a valid argument. We have to understand that, yes, the things that the Tea Party and the Libertarian movement and the Occupy movement, the things that we're all screaming about are actually happening, and they do need fixed.
No,
it is the path. You know, the Tea Party would say we have to have a moral society. The Libertarians would say we have to have less government. Occupy would say we probably would have to have less crony capitalism and more government to regulate that crony capitalism. So there's three different solutions, but there is that same underlying cause, because we all understand that, you know, when we couldn't afford the house, we could afford stuff in the 60s. And then we couldn't, you know, I remember when my parents were the first generation of my family where the mom couldn't stay home with the kids. She had to go to work.
Well, the 1950s are one of the best examples of how the American wages were very high, yet we exported a lot. So this idea that it's just cheap labor that is making it so that we're outsourcing jobs doesn't really hold water, because America in the 50s had very, very high wages and we were the top exporter in the world. What it comes down to, though, is there is a lot of push onto lower prices, but it doesn't work. You're starting at a step too far. The cost involved in a business does not determine the price. The price determines the cost. The price is set by the action of consumers and or sellers and buyers in the market on their own accord in the market. And that equilibrium price essentially works its way back through the production stages. One of the reasons why we have a decreasing wage in general can be determined from a lot of things. Like I said, wages, the amount is the value of what you can produce on the market, whatever you make and what it can sell for, discounted by interest and the equilibrium and all this kind of jazz. But nevertheless, production determines your wage, the consumer valuation of what you produce.
A common misconception to that is most people think it's time.
Time?
Time is what you're – what. Yeah, that's why you're paid by the hour.
Ways they pay your production. That's something you can there. But in a strict like
didn't mean to throw you off.
Man, he literally just looked at you like you pedestrian.
But my point is that over throughout the 20th century, we've had a policy of discouraging savings, which ultimately means discouraging capital expansion. We cannot be a wealthy nation if we do not have a capital structure. And what a recession is a market understanding that there has been a terrible misallocation of the capital goods in an economy. And right now we're going through that. We went through that in 2002, in 2001 with the recession then. Every recession, I mean, and this is not something – this is the Austrian theory of economics here. So I am definitely not, you know, parroting something you'd hear in a mainstream macroecon class. But nevertheless, capital misallocation is what causes recession. A lot of capital misallocation results in capital consumption.
All right, put that in English, please, because we're
– Capital – okay.
I don't want someone driving down the road to crash the car because they just fell asleep.
Essentially, the bare minimum thought of experiments, think of Robinson Crusoe. He could spend 24 hours a day picking berries, and he could say, let's have a round number of 100 berries at the end of the day if he just went up to a tree and started picking berries. Or he could – not consume berries 24 hours of the day. He could restrict his consumption, save. He could, that would be saving, and then he could go find a stick, which would be capital goods investment essentially, and he could shake the tree at the top and get more berries.
Right.
So while he restricted
it's a tool.
Yes.
It's a tool to help him work less.
Yes, he doesn't directly consume the stick, but he uses the stick to. That's capital. So I mean,
and the more berries that he saves, the less time he has to spend shaking the tree, which means he has more time for rest, relaxation, other things.
He could, building houses and blah, blah, blah,
right,
blah, blah. But essentially, you cannot have a society that is only consuming. I mean, it's literally impossible. I mean, they like to say that America's the consumer society. But I mean, in a strict theoretical or economic sense, you cannot have that. You have to have production in order to consume. If you don't produce TVs, you can't consume TVs. I mean, it's just pretty common sense.
All right. So if you want to get an overview of this entire theory, a great place to start is How an Economy Grows and Why It Crashes by Peter Schiff. It's a very easy read. I read it in like an hour or two. Lots of pictures. So for people like me, that is great. So check that book out, and it talks a little bit more about this. And part of the reason that our standard of living has grown, but our wages have, you know, stagnated a little bit. And so they've gone from the father going to work, coming home, the mother takes care of the kids, that madman sort of mentality, to a place where the standard of living rises. So now both parents have to work. And then it got to a place in the 90s and 2000s where, oh man, we can't keep up with the standard of living with both people working. So what do? We turn to credit. And then we get overextended. And that's why you have the economy crashing in 2008, is because people get too extended. And you also have Wall Street investment firms who are really building and trading nothing. They're just trading fiat money. Making horribly poor decisions that affect all of us.
But so. at root, it is a flawed monetary policy, a policy that says that low interest rates that are not set by the market increase investment, which technically is true. If you lower your interest rates below what the market would set it at, you will increase investment. But what it does is it masks, it hides the underlying valuations of people to save for the future and people to consume in the present. Essentially tricks people into saying that everyone wants to consume in the future and no one wants to consume now. So start investing in stuff because in the future you'll get a profit.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, everyone's still consuming in the present. So there's resource misallocation. Their price system fails to work because it has been manipulated by an extra market force. And you cause misallocation of investment in capital into sectors that are ultimately unprofitable. They're profitable for a while.
Electronics and
houses.
Right.
You misallocate investment into houses. Housing booms. Everyone's ooh, it's awesome and all this kind of stuff. But it has to end. It literally cannot continue forever. And that doesn't mean that's why our wages went down all the time. But when that happens, is you have a lot of capital consumption. People, instead of refurbishing their machines or anything and making it so that in the future they'll be able to produce as much or more, they consume their capital, they turn it into money without really realizing it, and therefore now they can only produce less. That creates a lower standard of living for everybody. And it's one of the reasons why your wages don't go as far, is because there's less production. Now, that doesn't mean that if you took, you know, production today to production 30 years ago, we still have more.
Mm-hmm.
But I mean, there's so many different things involved, but ultimately, the only reason I even started going off on this whole thing was that the idea that wages are set by the producer or the employer, and the employer alone is wrong. It's not. Oh, it could be wrong. It's misguided. No, it is downright wrong.
It's not your manager at the Red Robin that is, you know, trying to get one over on you. It's larger than just, you know, Dave, the manager at the Red Robin. It's not even the CEO of Red Robin. It's all connected.
And everybody is a producer and a consumer at the same time. When you go to work, you're a producer. When you buy food...
I'm literally producing a podcast right now.
Yes. Well, I mean, in economics, we're not getting paid for it. But anyway, when you go to work and you go work at McDonald's or wherever you work and you put in your 8 hours, you're producing for 8 hours. Mm-hmm. When you get off and you go buy a sandwich or you go and fill up your gas tank, you're consuming. When Bill Gates makes a new thing of Windows, he's producing. When he goes and fills up his gas tank or buys food, he's consuming. Everybody's both. That's why the market is not this division of classes. It is not a class division in the sense of there are two very distinct non-homogenous groups that are fighting over resources with each other in a zero-sum game. Mm-hmm. Everybody is both. You are at one point, you're a consumer, you're a producer, and you're adding both sides of the spectrum. And it's a market, and market sets all of it. And essentially, if Occupy Wall Street thinks the solution to all these problems is to put more government control in the economy and steal from those that have produced more to give to those who have produced less, ultimately, the logical conclusion of that, if you take it to its logical extent, is consumption on a mass scale with no production and poverty. And that's exactly what happened in the Soviet Union. That is exactly why they started off with a lot of – they were not poor at the beginning.
He's starting to yell.
They were not poor at the beginning. But they got ridiculously poor by the end.
Right.
And it was because over time, that's what happens. You produce, you stop, there is no incentive to produce, and there's no mechanism to organize production, and consumption takes over, and essentially, everyone's poor. Everyone dies in the streets of starvation. That's what happens.
Well, that's, you know, a rosy outlook on America. So let's wrap it up. What is the solution? What is Creighton Harrington's solution for the world?
Freedom. No. I mean,
you sound like Rick Santorum. I'm for freedom and liberty.
No, but it's pretty much obvious. I mean, you just there has to be less government involvement in your lives. I mean, it's a philosophy of government, but in an economic sense, the government can't do anything but consume anyway. Anything the market has the most efficient allocation of goods. And if the government tries to do something, it is by definition inefficient, and therefore net production will be negative, and you'll consume.
John Marshall said that taxes have the power to destroy.
The power to tax is the power to destroy.
Because basically the government consumes everything and produces nothing because it takes everything it has from someone else. And that's why when you unleash the free markets or the private sector like Warren G. Harding did in 1920 – then you have a depression that lasts a year. And in 1929, when you involve the government and the government gets involved, then you have the Great Depression that lasts 10 years because the government consumes nothing. It is the only entity that is not both a producer and a consumer.
It's absolutely right.
All right.
And it just consumes everything.
Yes, it does. And that, oh, no, and gobble, that, it, it is.
It's like
it
a
is,
black hole of
it
money.
It is, as Hobbes would say, a Leviathan. And
breaking up the man. Pawn Stars to Leviathan.
But anyway, so ultimately,
you can tell who reads in this room and who doesn't. So, all right. Well, we've got about 10 minutes left in the podcast. So let's move on to a different topic.
Well, I was thinking we could go on to our idiot of the week.
All right, and the idiot of the week is someone who is the most offensive to libertarian sensibilities. The person who has taken away freedoms or taxed us or has tried to grow the black hole that is government. So who is our idiot of the week?
The idiot of the week is NBC News for their media manipulation of the Zimmerman.
Yes.
Zimmerman.
NBC News, most of you have probably heard by now, took the 911 tape of George Zimmerman calling 911 and edited out the operator to make it sound like George Zimmerman volunteered the fact that Trayvon Martin was black, when in fact they asked for a description of the young man and George Zimmerman said he looks black.
And they actually asked for his racial description. They specifically asked for a racial description.
Now, we have not talked about Trayvon Martin and the George Zimmerman situation at all, and it's for a very specific reason, and it's mostly wrapped up in this entire situation, our Idiot of the Week NBC News.
And, I mean, ultimately it comes down to is we just don't know what the heck happened.
Right.
And no one does, except that really, I guess you could say, formally no one does because they haven't finished their investigation and they haven't had a court. They haven't had a trial. He's been charged as of yesterday,
but
they haven't had a trial. And we didn't want to get into it because we just really don't know what happened.
This is a situation charged with a lot of emotion on all sides and very little facts. And that's always dangerous territory. And it's something that really people who... It's something that people should avoid. I mean, I've personally avoided talking about it here on Facebook, anywhere, just because you don't know what happened, and you don't want to make people upset unnecessarily.
The exact opposite is happening. Everyone's talking about it.
Yeah, and that's
right.
And
it's
that's
become
what,
the number one news story.
And that is what, as
everywhere.
At heart, wrong with the whole – the only – I have no idea what happened. I have no idea. If it comes out that he killed this person in cold blood, he had no justified cause, then he should go to jail because he murdered somebody. If it turns out different and there is a reasonable doubt to say that, as law, common law would say, he should be considered innocent – or not innocent but not guilty of the charge of second-degree murder as he's been charged. I mean that's just basic legal doctrine there. But what I am mostly upset about with the whole situation is that – and it's the same thing happened with Casey Anthony. Before the facts have been tried in court, before they have been taken to their best interpretation by the experts or anybody, they have basically – the media has their verdict. They're putting their verdict on the American people to accept. They are accepting it, and people are essentially – they're in danger now because of this emotionally. Like, for example,
and if you look at the mugshot of Zimmerman, it looks like he's lost a ton of weight. I mean, he has really been tried in public opinion. I actually saw on Facebook yesterday somebody who said, "I'm glad that Zimmerman's lawyers quit. That POS doesn't deserve any legal representation, anyways."
Yeah,
and that is just flat out un-American.
Yeah,
that is wrong.
Absolutely, and. Ultimately, I mean, we don't know what happened, and we're making our judgment. And people like Spike Lee, who texted the address to someone whose house was named George Zimmerman, had the same name, but it ended up being some old couple that was not the George Zimmerman he thought. People turned up to their house, and they had to leave their house in fear of their lives because Spike Lee was an idiot. And
Roseanne tweeted out Zimmerman's parents' address. I mean, it's just...
There is a reason we have a court system in America.
Right.
There is a reason we have this stuff set up. Because when it comes down to it, who is Spike Lee? Who is Roseanne? Who are these people to be judge, jury, and essentially executor if they should make the trip up to the house?
And I'm not saying that Zimmerman is innocent or guilty because I really don't know, but it seems like at this point he had to be charged with something.
Yeah.
You know,
there was no way they were
not
going to charge.
You know, and I don't know if that's right or not. And the fact that I don't know if that's right or not means I don't really want to talk about it.
And I don't know either. I have no idea what happened. All I've heard is what everyone else has heard. I know that is not enough evidence for me to say that we can make a decision now. They have to go through all the process, and that's just basic. But what I do know is that no matter what happens, if he gets off or he gets – I mean, if he goes to jail, he goes to jail because he gets convicted. But if he gets off, that man is never going to be able to live a safe life in this country ever
again.
It's much
like Richard Jewell, the guy who was accused of being the Atlanta Olympics bomber in 1996. And he was, in fact, a security guard who thwarted the entire bombing. But he was originally blamed for the bombing at the Atlanta Olympics. And it ruined his life. And he died much younger than he should have. Because for the rest of his life, even though he was acquitted of all charges, he would go out in public and people would still associate him as the bomber. And, you know, it's just a dangerous media frenzy. And that's why NBC News is our Idiot of the Week.
Yeah, they had to publicly apologize too, didn't they?
And they fired the producer who did it. Because, you know, as someone who has edited audio for a long time, there's no way that the editor of that audio didn't know what he was doing.
Right.
He was editing it to make it look sensational. I mean, there's just no way around it. So,
and to a point that I've heard, and this is again, certain assumption or me thinking out loud, there is the possibility that they were editing it to fit a story that they had already predetermined was the truth.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what upsets me, is the media has defined what they believe to be the truth, that George Zimmerman is some closet KKK member and he's out there killing innocent black people all the time, and they're fitting the 911 call to fit their story. That's what's upsetting, and that's what's dangerous, is that if you have this judgment before the actual evidence comes out and you have people act upon that judgment, the media is not the trial. The media is not the jury. The media is not the judge. The judge and the jury are determined in our system in a certain way, and the media needs to just cover it and just – that's it. Just cover it.
Yep, and be impartial. So, all right. Well, that wraps up that particular topic. So let's talk about what's coming up in the next few weeks in and around Indiana. Gulp.
All right. Well, Creighton talked earlier about our Occupy the Honor Roll redistribute grade thing going on at IEPUI. So if you want to come and help out with that, bring your tent and your rats, and we're going to come and occupy under the business building.
What did you just – and rats?
I was just making
We walked by Occupy when we were in D.C.
Yeah, there were bunches of rats.
It's not a clean place.
Oh,
it's not.
Gross. Oh, that's disgusting. What the hell?
I didn't even see where their bathrooms were at.
But I think you did see where their bathrooms were at.
But, anyone can come and help make us look bigger, I guess, and help us talk to people about redistribution of wealth and grades and stuff. So,
and that whole week is...
We're also going to have a game show on Wednesday and Thursday of next week. We're going to be asking people pop culture questions and then following that up with, political questions and government questions and challenging people to... learn more about what's important instead of Kim Kardashian. And then...
did you hear she's dating Kanye West?
See, this is what I'm talking about.
Who cares?
What is wrong with her?
Oh, my God.
Yo, I'm going to have to stop you. I'm going to have to stop you right there, because Khloe Kardashian was clearly the best Kardashian of the year.
Oh, my God. Who
Anyway,
cares?
This is what I'm talking about. But other than that...
I just don't get it.
What else?
What does she see in him?
You guys. Creighton, you have any events for us? Like Tom Woods again, 21st.
That's
coming up soon.
Actually, I think...
Gotta register.
I think you have to register by... It'd be, the 14th? So today's the 12th. So that'd be Saturday. You'd have to register by Saturday, or else...
We'll post the link again on the Facebook.
If you don't register by Saturday, then they... can't let you go, because they have to have a head count for catering purposes and whatnot. But yeah, that's the 21st, but technically it's the 14th, because that's when you have to register.
Are there any Libertarian Party events coming up?
Yeah, on the 21st, if you are new to the Libertarian philosophy, if you're just on iTunes and you punch in the word Libertarian and you hear this podcast and you're mildly intrigued about what a Libertarian is... Libertarian Party of Indiana offers LP 101 classes, where we talk about the basics of the libertarian philosophy, and we talk about what the Libertarian Party is, why it exists, what we do, etc. And our next LP 101 class will be on April 21st in Newcastle at the library. We'll post a link in the show notes, so if you're looking on the podcast, click the description, or you can go to lpin.org and look at the notes there. And we also have candidate and volunteer training later that afternoon. So if you don't want to go to the LP 101 class, but you want to get involved in volunteering and campaigning, come to the session, and both are free and open to the public. So,
and apparently Chris Galt was incredibly interested in all that.
I know.
Sounds great.
Galt, how sleepy are you today? Because you really have not paid attention at all.
Right. You guys.
Thanks for joining us today on We Are Libertarians with my co-hosts,
Chris Spangle,
Creighton Harrington,
and I'm Chris Galt, and we'll see you again next week.
Hold on. Let's take a pause. You look that up, and I've got to...
Really? You guys brought up something that doesn't matter at all.
Rocket Man!
Rocket Man!
We're
gonna sit up here with your hair now.
Riding up here with my hair phone.
Why am I with Elton John?
I don't know. Why are you with all Elton John?
He's got electric boots.
Did you just hear him say, why am I with Elton John? What the?
All right.
This podcast is produced by What is a Hoosier Productions.